Let me teach you to use that wonderful voice that God has given you. Then you may never see me again, but you will never forget.
I think it's about unfair that you've been able to do the last 5 introductions and I haven't been able to do one.
Take it away then, no pressure.
Pressure is on. Welcome everyone to the last installment to the 6-part series of Hooked on Hammer, brought to you by Hooked on Horror. I'm sitting here with the host with the most, Mr. Adam Williams.
Hello there.
And joining him as always, the dispenser is Sansa, the left side of the testicle bag, Mike Murphy. Hello. And today we're sitting down for our 6th episode talking about the 1962 Phantom of the Opera, directed by Terence Fisher.
Come if you dare within these walls. On stage is color, beauty, and light. But in the shadows lurks a monstrous evil.
Written by Anthony Hines. Gaston Leroux obviously wrote the original novella in 1909. Shot again in Bray Studios, Mike.
Yep.
Music by Edwin Astley this time, though.
Different again from the other ones.
Yeah, who obviously the first couple we had were...
James Bernard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where did it change again? Curse of the Werewolf, wasn't there?
No, The Mummy had a different...
Oh yeah, The Mummy, didn't it?
Different soundtrack, didn't it? I think the first two films were James Bernard and then the other one have been others.
We don't have our previous podcast notes in front of us, that way. It's a lot to remember. Herbert Lom plays the Phantom. Michael Goff, of course, returns again. We're not going to discuss his role in Batman again and then go on to another Twins reboot we make. I do think it is something we should pitch to John Gore, though.
We've demonstrated our creativity with the Twins of Evil starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito.
That would just be glorious, wouldn't it? It would just be absolutely incredible. What more could you want from a film?
A plot.
I mean, yeah, to be fair. I can't really... There's not... Yeah. Heather Sears stars as Christine and Edward D'Souza as Harry Hunter. Not a bad adaptation, this one, Mike.
No, do you know how many adaptations of the book came before this?
Nope.
So this is the 8th one.
Flaming hell, boy. They're, like, at this point, it's only 1962 at this point.
Yeah. Well, there were...
Obviously, was the original the Universal one with Lon Chaney?
No.
Really?
I want to say 1912.
What year was the Lon Chaney one?
1925.
What? I never heard of this
1916.
I've never heard of this one.
Ooh, Norwegian adaptation.
Ooh.
Das Phantom der Oper! Das Gespenst im Opernhaus!
Just come from a podcast into like something to do with neo-Nazis. I'm not really sure we can continue, Mike.
I don't think Lenny Riefenstahl will direct our podcast.
Das is not good. That was very aggressively said, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah,
Scared me a little bit.
I didn't even sound Norwegian.
You sounded German.
I sounded Austrian, posing as a German. I sounded like an artist.
Well...
A failed artist, I might add. But 1925 was the one with Lon Chaney scene.
That's probably my favourite.
Yeah, the Universal silent film, which came before The Hunchback, I want to say, 1927, 1928.
The one where he, like, hurt himself because he wore that really heavy...
When did he not hurt himself?
Yeah, that is true to me. Lon Chaney really did... I wouldn't say overly commit, but he was like truly committed to his work. And if it hurt him, it hurt him.
Well, the London After Midnight with the opening of his eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And putting like little hooks to keep his eyes open.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
like,
God.
Clockwork Orange style.
Dude. Props to the guy, but oh, my God. Like, I'm not a fan of anyone going near my eyes on my teeth. my eyes on my teeth. Like, I called my dentist a C-word when she took my tooth out before. Ooh. I had to apologise afterwards. She was like, no, I've had worse.
bit of trivia for London After Midnight.
Yeah. He's been in the top hat, isn't he?
Yeah, the top hat. His eyes are open. He's got the filed teeth.
Yeah, that's a terrifying image.
Allegedly, a man had murdered his girlfriend after going to see the film in London, whoa, which, you know, kind of weird, which was the start of a well-known theory called hypodermic needle theory, which is when you watch something or read something, yeah, it's injected into your mind, so you are influenced by it. Of course, with a lot of understanding of how we use media,
yeah,
that's nowhere near true. You don't get injected with the information and then keep that information.
I remember
an opinion.
I remember doing this in media studies, or was it film, yeah, studies? I think we covered this in college, wasn't it?
And do you remember where he was replaced with?
God no, Mike. I can barely remember what I did yesterday. Like, Jesus Christ, man.
It was replaced by the uses and gratification theory.
Yeah, the uses and gratification. Yeah. See, I told you.
How you use and gratify that information. Yeah. So instead of being injected and submissively taken in and, yeah, using that information there, it's how you gratify that information so you have an opinion to go against it.
Yeah.
But because of this high-profile case that had happened in the late 20s, I want to say 27 or 28, they introduced the hypodermic needle theory.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you say, like studying film is like ruined it in some aspect? It has for me a little bit. But I can't just watch a film and like just switch off and enjoy something now.
Yeah.
Like, I nitpick at everything.
Yep. Studying film ruined the enjoyment of watching films.
I don't know. I can still sit there and like, you know, films that I've watched countless times, like, I don't know, Jaws, Halloween, or Star Wars films, for example.
Rob Zombie's Halloween, yeah.
One does not simply mention Rob Zombie's Halloween. Yeah, that was a shame, though, because Tyler Mane was a great Michael Myers.
Yeah.
That's for another podcast. Because if we go down that wormhole, you're going to have to edit, like, 9 hours worth of footage of me just ranting, screaming, and complaining about stuff again.
And I don't want to do a repeat of episode 2.
That can be arranged. I am going to make you rewatch The Two-Face of Dr. Jekyll at some point.
Oh, that was episode 4.
Yeah, I know, but that, like you said, you'd rather stick pins in your eyes than watch that again.
I'd rather walk through hot coals.
Again, that could be arranged. Like, a couple of phone calls, I'm sure I could sort something out.
I'd rather be taxidermied alive.
What, you need to be dead for me to do that, Mike?
What, alive?
Oh, I missed the alive part. Yeah, like, have we even got to the film yet? We haven't, have we?
I mentioned it.
Yeah, you said this was the 8th adaptation.
Yeah, I did.
did it about 25 minutes ago. Thoughts on it? Like, you know, what would you consider this one of the better adaptations? Because I didn't mind this. I quite enjoyed this one.
I thought it was fine. I didn't think it really had... Well, a few set pieces were decent.
I think Michael Goff's performance in this was phenomenal.
Him and Herbert Lahm stole the film, yeah.
Herbert Lahm, yeah, the Phantom.
Yeah.
To be fair. The cast all in all were pretty decent, but those two in particular, I think.
I find it really strange, like, looking at Herbert Lahm as the Phantom as Eric in this and thinking back to The Ladykillers in 1955 as him as Mr. Harvey. And he's supposed to be like this exotic, foreign kind of like man, and like, he wants to kill Mrs. Wilberforce more than anybody else. And then in this, he's really sympathetic.
Oh, that is a fantastic film. And to be fair, Mike, that was a decent introduction. Like, you didn't need about 25 takes. And, you know, you didn't mess up multiple times and, you know, call yourself a completely different name. And
Not on the finished edit.
Anyway, let's get into the film then. So, cue the footsteps.
Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
In the name of God, you dare not!
This is more than a superstition, I know. The danger is very real.
Yes, a criminal lunatic, he tried to kill you.
We've discovered the source of life itself, and we've used it to restore a creature that was dead.
It begins. Come on.
The The intro to this reminded me of the one from Curse of the Werewolf, because it goes into the location of the underground dwelling that the Phantom lives in.
Playing the organ, innit?
Yeah. And then we get, like, that close-up of his eye.
Yeah.
Very similar in Curse of the Werewolf, where we have the close-up of the eyes.
Oh, yeah, it is, isn't it?
Then we get all the titles over the top of it.
Pretty solid opening.
Yeah, better than The Mummy and... Is it Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, where it was a book?
The one you just hated from start.
I absolutely hated that film.
Yeah, you weren't a fan of that one, were you?
The Crime of Being Boring.
Yeah, let's not talk about that. We don't want to, you know, make someone on this podcast into a negative Nancy. I'm not going to mention names here.
I don't give a fuck. His name was Mike.
Fucking Mike.
So from there, we go straight into the theatre and it's opening night of a brand new opera, The Tragedy of Joan Arc by Lord Ambrose Darcy, a.k.a. Michael Gough. It was difficult watching him in it. Not difficult in the sense he was difficult to watch because he was bad. Oh, I'm used to seeing him as Alfred Pennyworth.
Yeah.
He's a dick in this. I know you're a big fan of Paul Kremper, the Chad. And I've even got it written in my notes here that Michael Gough's character in this, he out-chads the chaddiest Chad, which makes him the biggest Chad. He's a proper creep in this.
He is a massive creep. I still think Paul Kremper is the chaddiest of all Chads. And Paul Arnold is the coolest of the Chads. And then...
From the Two Faces.
Yeah, Two Faces. Which is a shame, because he was in that film. And Michael Gough is the rapiest, horrible human being.
Yeah, he's a piece of work in this, to be fair.
Yeah. And I echo, like, your sentiment of hard to watch. You saying that about him being Alfred. It's the same with me with Kurt Russell when I watched the second Guardians of the Galaxy film. Because Kurt Russell isn't a bad guy. He can't be a bad guy.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. That was a bit odd. Or Harrison Ford in What Lies Beneath.
Oh, yeah, that took me out.
That threw me, man. I was like, dude, this is Han Solo in Indiana Jones. Like, he's not going on killing women and having affairs.
Yeah, yeah. Michael Gough playing Darcy, who of course has written, inverted commas, The Tragedy of Joan Arc.
Quote unquote, but we find out later in the film. Spoilers, sorry folks. But, you know, this film was made in 1962. Yeah. I mean, we said it in previous ones, like, you know.
Can't spoil, like, over 60 years.
Yeah. Can bet you there'll still be one person like, my God, I was going to watch this next week. How dare you? Anyway, yeah, he's apparently written this opera. What are you looking at?
Sure, I've got the silent film, Tragedy of Joan Arc.
I'm assuming it's somewhat similar to this, then.
Yeah, but not a musical, because it's a silent film.
Yeah, well, no shit. You know, they're not going to start doing the jazz singer halfway through, are they?
Has a wonderful... No, that was racist, that film.
The original jazz singer?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was a huge film in regards to it opened avenues for film to change, basically, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, that was the first talkie, feature talkie. Yeah.
Just ignore the racism part of it.
Again, disclaimer in front of the film to say this was made of the time. This, you know, it's not, you know, representative, like, of current views.
It's one of those
opinions.
Things where it's, you know, you shouldn't forget history. You should learn from it.
Well, exactly. Those who choose to forget history are doomed to repeat it.
You didn't come up with that quote, did you?
Nope.
I was about to be like, that's the words of wisdom from Mike Bennett. And I was like, that's way too good to be Mike's quote. Who did say that?
I can't remember.
How convenient.
There's also another really good quote. Wash on, wash off.
How did you misquote The Karate Kid?
I don't think I've ever actually seen The Karate Kid.
Haven't you?
No.
Fucking Mike.
So we got Michael Gough as Lord Ambrose Darcy in the theatre, opening night. It's quite an extravagant theatre. And Latimer comes down. Who plays Latimer again?
Solly Walters.
He's pretty good in this, to be fair.
Yeah, I quite liked him.
But he comes down and says, oh, it's a sellout. And Darcy turns around and says, oh, you know, no more incidents then. You're a bit like, well, okay, what's going on here? Kind of, like, opens the questions up a little bit for the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
In time,
what type of incidents are going on?
Yeah, basically, to make him come out and say that. And then we go straight into Maria practicing in her dressing room, I suppose it would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah, private dressing room, because she's the star of of the show.
Gets sent flowers and she's like, oh, is that it?
They were diamonds last time.
It's a snooty upper class. They were sent by bitch,
Darcy, like, weren't they?
Yeah. She basically has a bit of a run-in with the Phantom.
Yeah, you the see first the glimpse
gas of gaslights kind of come down, don't you? You don't really see what goes on or what happens in that idea.
No, you just see his hand and he tries talking to it, doesn't he?
Like, this is intercut with, you know, the stage being prepped, then you get the first glimpse of the Phantom's hand as he's watching him prep everything, basically.
Yeah,
scares the opera singer by going boo.
Nice little smash cut as well.
Yeah, with the symbols, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember what that motif is called.
Hitchcockian.
There isn't actually a formal name for that type of editing, but Hitchcock was renowned for using the Kuleshov editing techniques, where you montage things together to make meaning out of something. So
yeah,
you could apply it to the sound editing of someone's about to scream, and then you get the high pitch whistle of the train and Kuleshov effect, or a Hitchcockian methodology.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Thank you.
It's all a bit chaotic from there. Maria's refusing to come out of her dressing room. Harry, the producer, comes in. Played, of course, by Edward D'Souza. Mm-hmm. I am saying that right, you know, D'Souza.
I believe so, yeah. D'Souza.
D'Souza. We'll go with D'Souza. Harry manages to get her to convince her to let him in. We kind of get the first sort of description of the Phantom here. Obviously, we saw him briefly in the opening credits.
Yeah.
But this sounds terrifying. Like an eye in the middle of his forehead.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds absolutely terrifying.
Like he's some sort of cyclops or something.
Leela from Futurama.
Yeah. There are other people who are mentioning incidents that are going on as well.
Kind of like just gloss over this quickly, but there appears to be various things going wrong, from like music going missing,
drum stuff, kits being
damaged,
sliced.
Yeah. Scenery being damaged and stuff as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a bit bizarre, really.
It's almost like sabotage on opening night.
Well, they say, I think one of them says at some point, it's like somebody's playing a joke and the conductor's just had a guts for it. And he's like, somebody's doing too many of them.
Yeah.
Just already at his wit's end, the show hasn't even started. It's opening night. <Yeah. eyes. laughs> So from there, the opera music starts and the show just begins. And we get a quick glimpse up into
the private box with Latimer and Harry.
He has a great pop at Darcy in this bit, Harry does.
Not knowing that he's standing right behind him.
Yeah. Comes in late because he's got to make an entrance because he's a proper Chad.
Yeah.
Gets noticed by the crowd, gets his applause to feed his ego.
Has a go at Mortimer as well because it's supposed to be a sellout show.
And the box he says empty. About the box, doesn't he? Mm. There's some superstitions like that in some theatres.
Yeah, like across the UK we have quite a few of them where you like leave a light on or you leave a chair empty.
Isn't the one that they filmed the original Universal 1925 one on, isn't that supposedly haunted by Lon Chaney?
The backlot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to be
one of the oldest existing sets, and the one that they shot Frankenstein, the courtyard and all that. I know that's still there because I was used in Van Helsing as well.
That's right, yeah.
I'm trying to think, they probably are the oldest existing sets, aren't they?
Would be, because most of them are just recycled. Especially in the Silent Era when they took on Ford's method of conveyor belt filmmaking.
Yeah.
You just had constant reusing of set, demolishing sets and things like that for multiple films that were filmed side by side.
Quite coolly, like, built the whole opera house, basically.
Yeah, including the catacombs. There's that beautiful, like, sepia shot of Christine on the horse in the background of these massive arches.
Yeah.
So it kind of looks like a viaduct.
Yeah.
Type thing. Yeah.
There's quite a few of these scenes, so we're kind of just going to gloss over them quickly. You basically get to see the opera in its entirety for certain scenes, don't you, in quite a few bits of this film.
Yeah.
Which, you know, they weren't bad, but I...
They just don't push the story along, the first one that we see and the last one.
It was a bit like the flashback scene in The Mummy.
Yeah.
It just felt a little bit like filler, and it was a bit like, I'm not really interested in seeing all of this. You could just give me, like, a bit more of a highlights feel, so to speak.
Whereas the Mummy one had all that exposition that they were trying to fill in.
And the only time we actually saw Christopher Lee properly be able to act in the film.
Whereas the opera side of things, it is just a more of a spectacle. And if you're into that, then fair enough.
Did Universal have any input with this?
Not to the extent of the mummy.
I was going
to
say, because it might have, again, you kind of got that impression with the mummy, like maybe they stepped in and were like, oh, you need to make this a bit more theatrical.
Maybe if they did, it wouldn't have flopped as much and had Fisher step away from Hammer for 2 years.
Yeah, that's true. The only bit I did really enjoy in this is when the guard sings "You Lousy Frenchie" at one of them.
Oh, yeah.
That was quite funny, wasn't it? But yeah, like, as I said, we're not really going to go into detail about that. You kind of get, is the divorce, like, watching off from the rafters, basically, isn't it?
And yeah.
You don't really get any background on him throughout the entire of the film. I'm not calling him a dwarf as a derogatory term. If you actually go and look at the credits, he is credited
as the dwarf. The dwarf. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Come at me.
Yeah, come at me, bro. But yeah, that's what he's credited as. He's not even that small.
He's more like five foot two, maybe 5 foot three.
He's no Frodo or, you know,
no.
Bilbo or anything. Who was the dwarf played by Mike?
Ian Wilson.
He's pretty good in this, to be fair.
I didn't really care much for the character. I don't feel like he added anything except for a bit of conflict.
I enjoyed him, but I enjoyed it because it reminded me a little bit of Charlie in Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and he's been huffing paint and he's like hiding in the walls in his like crawl space and that. A few sandwiches short of a picnic, shall we say.
Yeah. And I mean, I can see why Ian Wilson didn't really flourish.
Yeah.
I think the last thing I saw him in was The Wicker Man.
Yeah.
And again, bit role, not really doing much. And I don't feel he did much in this except for act almost like Dwight Fry in the 1930s Universal films, where he's just like, I'm menacing and I'm gonna kill you. But he didn't say anything.
Were those direct quotes from the script for that?
Yeah.
This is why you're not paid to write, Mike. The worst, like, watching on from the rafters, basically, isn't it? You don't really get much of what's going on until...
You know he's an ominous character, though.
Yeah, until Maria really comes out and starts doing her bit on the stage. Mm. And you hear this massive rip in the stage scenery. Body just comes swinging through and he's been hung.
This part I didn't quite understand.
How do you mean?
Whose hand was ripping through the sheet?
Maybe the dwarf was like swinging on him and then dropped down far enough and then he swung through.
But how would the body swing at the angle that
I
it
don't
did?
Know, Mike. You're overthinking things. Just fucking move past it.
Fucking Mike.
God, you vex me sometimes.
I mean, even if he was holding on to the guy and he dropped with him, you would have heard that snap.
Fucking Mike.
That's kind of the whole that kind of puts an end to the show. They're not going to carry on. Yeah. I know the show must go on and all that, but can't do a Wizard of Oz and carry on filming with a guy hanging in the background. Allegedly, may I add. Because of that, we cut to the next day. A poster is being amended, basically. They're putting a postponed indefinitely notice over the top of it. And then we cut to Latimer and Darcy.
Yeah, Darcy's kicking off because, you know, narcissistic tendencies of himself. It looks bad on him and he wants to be the showman, be the centre of attention. He even asks Latimer, why do the police have to get involved? A man's just died!
Proper Chad, dude. That's what I told you, he's a proper Chad. I've even put in my notes here, this is a direct quote from my notes, such a big-headed twat.
Yeah.
He's just a piece of work.
That's because Harry's holding auditions for the next Christine, because Maria's just had enough now. She's walked out.
Well, yeah, you can't blame her, to be fair.
Yeah, she's just had, like, a swinging
corpse. Yeah. He goes back to being a Chad again. He goes down and kicks off with these auditions, doesn't he? And then gets a notice of, is it Christine?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. First notice is here and just turns into a full-on creep again.
Yeah, he's like the cat who's got the cream smiling.
It's when he turns around and he's like, she's a lovely, lovely girl. I mean, and Harry's got to turn around and be like, she's got a nice voice as well, dude. Yeah. That's the reason she's here in the first place. You utter creep.
Yeah. Like, it did make my skin crawl a little bit.
Yeah.
You can see where Darcy's priorities are. It's like when Maria hinting at she got the bouquet of flowers, but oh, there were diamonds in it last time.
Yeah. Kind of says it all, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, what Darcy's doing behind the scenes.
Well, we find out in the next scene then, don't we?
Exactly.
She's in a dressing room, isn't she?
Yeah, and Latimer brings her the little card to essentially invite her to dinner with Darcy.
The girls with her are nice enough to like lend her money and go out and get her stuff, and they leave her alone in the dressing room then, and she gets her first interaction with the Phantom. Mm. Well, unseen again at this point.
Yeah, because it's just his voice, but as you mentioned in the previous time that he appeared, the gaslight dims.
Yeah.
And you hear him speaking to her from a unknown place.
I do like his voice.
Yeah, I really like Herbert Lom's voice in this. It made me think of the scene in the Andrew Lloyd Webber 2004 Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
Where she is, well, I suppose in the her private dressing room, and then the booming voice of Gerard Butler comes through talking about...
Oh, yeah, I forgot it was Gerard Butler, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Very young Gerard Butler.
2 years before 300?
Oh, I thought it was longer than that, but... Well, to be fair, he was made to look a bit older.
Yeah, he had a beard and everything.
It's the facial hair, man.
Yeah.
He actually looked like a man.
This is opera!
I paid to see that.
Kicks Darcy out of his box.
You'll find a lot of music scripts down there.
Brilliant.
But yeah, the Phantom just, he doesn't do much in the scene. He kind of just warns her how big a creep Darcy is. And then we go straight into the dinner scene with her and Darcy. She's looking quite nervous in this scene, and rightly so. Oh, it's just, the longer this scene goes on, it just gets progressively worse.
Yeah.
She even says at one point, oh, no. And he's like, do you want to sing in my opera or what? And it's like, oh,
yeah.
Dude, man, like, again, this is difficult. This is a difficult watch.
One of the things, whilst I was watching it, and especially that dinner scene and what the ramifications would be, and obviously could have been with Maria prior to Christine.
Yeah.
And, of course, is with the person that he gets to replace Christine later on, is that this is 1962, where exploring this type of archetypical character, you know, this trope or stereotype of a
high
man,
society, basically,
abusing their position to exploit sexual favors out of young up and coming actresses. And I mean,
golden age of Hollywood was rife with that.
Well, exactly. And we're talking about it in 1962, and we're still talking about it today of, you know, atrocities that have happened within the industry. And it's
still
sickening.
Still happening in some cases. Still being investigated in some cases.
Well, exactly. And a lot of talk at the moment with high profile cases that, you know, are going on. But when people say there's too much red tape these days for anything and everything, we need to go back to the good old days. These are the inverted commas good old days.
Yeah.
I refuse the positive ideological stance people have of nostalgia. This is atrocious. It has no place being in society, so I'm all for safeguarding.
No, 100% with you there. She kind of doesn't succumb to his advances and...
Well, he's trying to ply her with as much alcohol as possible.
All that, and then they go to leave, and she's basically bumped into Harry and essentially begs him for help. And that kind of forces Darcy to be like, oh, well, it is late then.
Oh, yeah, even that response. It's a slimy, horrible...
You just want to slap him, don't you?
Like... He's just a twat. He's just a horrible human being.
See you next Tuesday with a capital C.
Yes.
But
it's just horrible.
Yeah, he goes, thankfully.
I like how I'm getting to the level of anger that I have for two tails of this character.
Two faces, you mean?
Two faces.
If you're going to insult the film, like, at least say its name correctly.
It doesn't deserve to be remembered correctly.
So Harry and Christine decide to have dinner in his establishment. She admits she was too nervous to eat before, basically.
Yeah, and Harry's pretty much saved her from a horrible thing.
Then progression of time. They're in a cabby then, on their way home originally. It's a bit... I know Harry's like being a decent guy, but he's laughing and he's like, oh, he must have been furious. And it's like, if you know this is going on, like, why don't you do something about it? Like,
and it's his priority is to make Darcy angry and frustrated because he thinks it's
instead
funny.
Of actually like dealing with the issue head on. Yeah. This is where we get the reveal. Well, Christine reveals to Harry that she heard somebody when she was in her dressing room.
Yeah.
Just before this, obviously, Harry began pressing her. Well, he didn't press her. He said, we've had a bit of a run of strange bad luck since this has started. And that is when Christine admits that she had a bit of an encounter with somebody in her dressing room. So they change their route, of course, to the theatre. And it's quite funny. They say to the cabbie, can you take us to the theatre? And he's like, well, it's closed.
And you recognised who the first cabbie was?
He didn't look well, whoever he was.
Yeah, our good friend and bulgy-eyed, scary man, Michael Ripper.
Was Michael Ripper? Yeah. Oh, bloody hell.
He looked rough.
He kind of looked like he'd been left outside in the cold for a bit too long. It almost looked like he was beginning to frost over a little bit.
Well, he looked exactly the same as he did in The Mummy. Terrifying.
Oh, I didn't know that. It completely went by me.
But they have that weird, like, it's just like a weird tone, but I think it's a trope for Hammer films, because you have that interaction with Michael Ripper.
Yeah.
They go to the theatre, and then you have the cleaning ladies.
Yeah, that was quite a comical scene, to be fair.
Yeah, they're all there just like, oh, what have you found?
Well, it's when she first accuses him of taking Christine there to bang her. In a dark corner, as she puts it, courting in a dark corner. And then when he's like, oh no, I'm actually a producer of this. Oh, is that right? Well, I'm the Queen of England. it was like, oh my God. And he only manages to get by him by outsmarting him by being like, oh, I dropped the diamond brooch here last night.
Oh, which section were you in? Oh, blah, 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 blah. That's my section!
They all go running off.
But then I saw it more as kind of like, they could have just walked in anyway.
Yeah.
Because he is the producer and whatever else. But I saw it more as, oh, let's take the mick out of like the working class here. You know, they're lower than us. Oh, I dropped like a diamond necklace.
Even when they bump into the rat catcher now, obviously the women go running back off because they think it's the Phantom.
Oh yeah, they're scared of it.
No, just the rat catcher. Yeah. And, again, very reminiscent of Charlie Kelly. But like, again, this is quite a comical scene. He's like, oh, God, I'll show you some of the ones I've caught. He's like going to get him out, and she's like, can you make him stop, please?
Yeah.
And then when he even turns around, he's like, well, I'll sell them to you. They make a lovely pie.
Yeah.
We're vegetarian, actually. Yeah. I thought that was quite a good line.
Yeah, it was weird.
Like, yeah. Bit of an odd interaction, wasn't it?
Yeah, and seeing the rat catcher like come out, and he's like this dirty, like shadowy bloke played by Doctor Who. And the priest from The Omen, Patrick Troughton.
Is it?
Yeah. And it's just weird, you know, seeing him as this role.
Well, we don't see him again after this, because...
Well, he doesn't see anything either.
No. I mean, there's no messing around here in front of the dwarf. He just jumps down from the rafters after he leaves Harry and Christine. And he just stabs him straight in the eye.
I was shocked.
Straight in the face. There's no messing around, nope. Right? There was no, I'm going to maim him slightly. No, just kill him.
Yeah.
Immediately get rid of him.
I was shocked to see, like...
Did the censors have any issues with that?
Of course they did.
Go on, then.
You see him dive, and then you see Trenton fall.
Yeah.
So they had the whole stab in the eye.
So you actually saw the stab in the eye originally?
You never saw it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they had it cut out.
Yeah, the dwarf just kind of drags him off then into his lair, basically.
And Harry goes to...
At least the rats run out, don't they? So he goes to check, basically, what's going on, leaving Christine. And you get another interaction with the Phantom then.
Yeah.
So at the top of the stairs, quite creepy, basically.
I think this is a good part to talk about the cinematography and the camera movement within this. Of course, we've got Arthur Grant as the DOP for this one.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like the other Hammer films that we've watched, especially what we mentioned in Curse of Frankenstein and Dracula, where something's obscure in the foreground, the action is in the midground, and then in the background you have even more of the set. For this, it didn't feel as polished movement as well. Of course, we have the Phantom appear at the top of the stairs, and the camera kind of like tilts and tracks up the stairs, but it's shaking as it's going up, so it doesn't feel
not as
clean.
Good as like the Curse of Frankenstein reveal and stuff like that.
No.
Yeah, you don't really get a lot out of this scene. It's just really another interaction and goes into the next day then.
Yeah, because Christine just passes out.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Faints.
Oh.
Yeah. That was pretty good.
We find out immediately then what's happened the next day, because they're holding auditions again.
Yep.
Latimer and Darcy, the ultra Chad, reiterates again in this scene how big a Chad he is with the redhead.
The person who will replace Christine.
Yeah, that doesn't even sing an opera song, and then he kicks off at her later because she can't sing an opera song. So, like, you know exactly why you hired a dude, so this is your fault, if anything. Christine's been fired.
And of course, with Harry finding out that Christine is essentially sacked, in solidarity, he leaves as well and invites Christine to go for lunch, considering they've both been sacked.
Yeah, he says, let's celebrate, we both got the sack, basically.
Yeah.
Leaves her to get ready, and we get a pretty big part of the story comes in.
Yeah, with inside the landlady's living room, I assume.
It's the dressing screen. It's something drawn on the dressing screen, basically. And he's like, where did you get this music from?
Oh, yeah, it's the music sheets.
Yeah, she's like, oh, well, the professor left me enough to pay for the house. So he must have done bloody tons for her.
Yeah.
He asks to see the sheet music. She comes back and he plays it on the piano and he recognises it. And he inquires what happened to the professor, and she's like, oh, he died, burned to death in the fire at the printers. And she gives him the name of the printers, and instead of going for lunch, he decides, well, I'm going to pursue this printers, Piggott's, I think it is.
Which I think is a damn shame, because I think I'd prefer to go to lunch.
Just if we go over this one a bit quickly, because there's quite a lot to take in these scenes.
Because it's all about the investigation of what happened to this mysterious professor, because the sheet music was identical to the tragedy of Joan Arc.
And find out that, you know, they think it was a burglar that broke in.
Yeah.
Accidentally set the place on fire, went to put it out with what he thought was water. It turned out to be acid. Why he puts it on his table, he burned his own table.
Yeah.
Just to prove a point, and he was like, you could have just told them, they would have believed you. Yeah. Like, you just wrecked your own desk at work, basically, just to prove a point.
When somebody tells you, don't put your hand in the water, it's hot. Well, they don't then put their hand in there to demonstrate how hot it is.
Yeah, but then part of me is like, yeah, but is he just telling me that? If I actually put my hand in it, is it actually going to be hot? Bloody hell. One thing as well I did find quite funny in this is... It's just me, because I'm, mental capacity of a teenage boy, when he says master printer.
Did you think of Captain Pugwash and all those interesting names? Yeah. Lord Master Bates.
Oh, it tickled me a little bit, I don't know why. You get a little bit of a glimpse of the backstory of what happened.
Yeah, we pretty much summarise everything and condensed it down.
But then he says about going for lunch, and he's like, oh, it's way past lunch.
Early tea, then.
Yeah. Progression of time again, and we see him again in the back of a cabby. They're, you know, cozying up a little bit, and this is where Harry tells Christine that no wonder Darcy's done so well, because he didn't like the bloody thing in the first place.
Yeah.
And we find that he tells Christine, and she's like, were you going to do anything? He's like, well, can't really do anything. He's dead, basically. He's going to have enough trouble writing another one.
Yeah. And who is our cabbie this time?
Who is the cabbie this time?
It's Miles Mallison.
Who is in...
We saw him in Dracula, the funeral home.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he was funny in Dracula.
He's quite funny in this.
Yeah, I was going to say he's quite funny in this. Like, we won't ruin this scene for you, but if you've seen it, you'll know what we're on about. But I was watching it and I was just like, my God, this guy is... He must have won so much of the Bad Timing Award. Yeah. It's just one part after the other. You're like, dude, just read the room, leave him alone.
He did the same in Dracula. He's kind of like, yeah. Oh, they've come to check the thing, and he's making awkward jokes. This time he's doing it, and he also does it as the hangman in Kind Hearts and Coronets.
It's when he turns around in this, and they go to kiss, he's like, I'm sure it'll be the first night of many, my love. And he's just like... Harry's just looking at him like, can you shut up, dude? Just ruined the mood completely.
That just made me think of the beggar in Curse of the Werewolf. Have a good night.
That was his first mistake. Yeah. It's that meme, innit? At this point, he knew. He fucked up. So Christine gets dropped home, all joyful and grateful and quite happy with how the night's gone.
Yeah.
Goes to open the window. Boom! Dwarf.
Yeah.
Don't really see much after that. I kind of just smash cut straight to the Phantom on his organ in that beautiful toccata in D minor on the organ.
Yeah.
It's just a great piece of music, to be honest.
And what does it go like?
Da-da-da. Da-da-da.
I thought you were also going to go into the Uruk-hai theme in
what?
The Uruk-hai theme in Lord of the
Rings. Where's I need to go and get changed, Mike. Wait, there. I need changed and a metal bandit.
It's like the Foley artists.
Yeah, they're fascinating to watch.
See, like, oh, this is thunder, and then it's like a metal sheet.
It's fascinating how they do stuff like that.
Sad bastards.
The dwarf takes Christine back to the lair. We kind of see some of the little like secret passages and stuff he's been using. Because he moves like... Is it a boiler or something? Or a massive piece of machinery?
Yeah, yeah.
Just pops the wall out and just moves to the side. Like he's just pushing a table across.
Was that in the house or was that in the opera?
I'm pretty sure that was in the opera theatre.
Why did she go back to the theatre if she got sacked?
She didn't.
Oh, he took her back.
Yeah, the dwarf took her back.
That's right.
God, Mike, keep up.
Yeah.
We're only discussing the whole film in a podcast, you know, don't worry.
Here's a question for you then.
Oh, God, what is the meaning of life?
How'd they get the organ down there? How'd they get the little sex bed down there? Because, I mean, they've kitted her out to live in.
Yeah, but do you think this was not done by the dwarf before? Because he kind of just found the phantom, didn't he? The bed was probably there, and the organ, maybe.
Why would the organ be in the sewer?
I don't know. Maybe he wanted a project to keep himself occupied in between huffing paint and murdering people. So, yeah, maybe he just like, saw bits of an organ and thought, ooh, well, I'll put that back together.
Pretty intelligent dwarf for, like, a mute.
Well, he knew to stab somebody straight in the face, didn't he?
Well, children do that.
Yeah, but they don't know they're meant to stab you in the face. They just think it's funny. It's okay, that's daddy never being able to work again.
So you're defending the dwarf's actions?
I'm not defending the dwarf's actions.
This is where we get the intentions of Eric, the fandom.
Yeah.
Basically outlining that he loves Christine's voice and wants to teach it, and it needs more lessons to be perfection, and that he will be forcibly her teacher to perfect her singing and be able to sing his opera.
Well, you keep saying, didn't he, when you sing, you'll sing only for me.
I loved the kind of like hand gesture only, that he did.
It came up a couple of times throughout the film, and it's quite intimidating, but interesting at the same time.
Well, it's a weird one because he's also showing a bit of almost like a split personality or suffering from psychosis.
There's a few moments throughout the film where he's gone in the head, basically.
Yeah, he's reliving the past.
Yeah.
And can't centre himself. Massively. Except for when he's playing and teaching.
Yeah.
That's when he's fully centred. Otherwise, when he's talking back and forth with Christine, he's turning around and saying, no, it was mine. You stole it from me.
Do you think that's why he took the Mummy Dearest approach to teaching her?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But it appears... Well, as Christine's being given teaching lessons, basically, Darcy, I've actually written in my notes here, Darcy kicking off like an utter melt.
Yeah.
Because he is kicking off like an utter melt. I love it, though, when he says something to the conductor, because it's just like...
If I want your help, I'll ask for it. Then you should ask for it.
Yeah, just rips into him, basically. Yeah. So he sacks the conductor, but, like, in true, like, gentlemanly fashion, he turns around to the orchestra and he goes, gentlemen... Good day. Yeah. And just walks off, but all the orchestra go with him. Obviously, they've all been sacked as well.
Well, they don't want to work for Darcy.
Yeah. So Harry comes back to another shit show, basically.
Yeah.
And it goes into a comical scene with Latimer.
Yeah.
Where he finally stands up to Darcy.
Yeah, he grows a backbone.
Yeah, as Harry puts it. He basically says you need to get Harry back. Says you need to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
I've got a duty of care to my people. Like the director of the theatre, he says, isn't it?
It's basically like the theatre group stakeholders. And
yeah, grows a backbone and he just kicks off at Darcy.
Yeah.
Darcy doesn't like it. Harry comes back in. It's quite funny. He's like, oh, I think I need to sit down after that. Pours him a brandy. He's like, well, we'll have a brandy. Let's get back to work. So they go down, start rehearsing and everything then. And then somebody comes down with a message for Harry. This is like kind of intercut with footage of Christine in the Phantom's lair as Harry's investigating and trying to find out what's happened to her.
I don't know, this scene didn't feel polished. Like, the intercutting between him investigating where she's gone and Christine being trained, it didn't feel to flow all that well with one another. And of course, Christine is being slapped and she's having sleep deprivation.
Throws the water over at one point as well.
Yeah, to wake it up.
When he first said to him, "Get me water," I was like, "Oh, that's nice, he's getting a drink." And then he picked it up out of the minging water. I was like, "I hope he's not going to make a drink like that." Then he just lobs it over and I was like, I guess that's okay.
It's better than forcing it.
You know, it's not going to cause a dysentery or anything like that. So.
Well, as long as it wasn't still water, then it would be fine.
No, it was flowing. There was a river in there.
There were turds in there.
Well, back in those days, probably God knows what in there.
He allows it to sleep eventually.
Yeah.
And that's when Harry finds the great lead into the sewer.
Well, he's been investigating, didn't he? And he kind of kicks off at the police saying, "Why did you drag the river? You know, he died." And he's like, "Well, the river's fast flowing anyway."
Yeah, because they mentioned that the person who had caused the fire, the printers, jumped into the river.
Yeah, you get all the backstories intercut, but like this moment now where Harry comes into the lair, he gets into a fight with obviously the dwarf, overpowers the dwarf.
But the dwarf does like something really great.
Dude, he does like, is it Apocalypse Now? Where he's like just in the water and he just comes up out of the water. It's like, whoa, okay.
He does the Robin Hood thing from Disney's animated Robin Hood, where he's got a little bamboo straw and going under the water.
I can't help it reminding me of Without a Paddle.
Oh, yeah.
Where Seth Green's going and a bug crawls in.
There's that one shot that I really liked where Harry's kind of like wading through the water going a little further, and you see the tube go past him.
Can we edit that and put the Jaws music over the top of it? Dun, 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 dun.
Just swim! Don't look around! Can we go home now?
But yeah, we go into the Phantom's Lair now. He's overpowered the dwarf.
Yeah, and
after he's apocalypse nowed his way out, way into him and everything. But this is where we actually see what happened firsthand to the Phantom. We get the full backstory now.
Yeah, and we get to see Herbert Lom without the mask on.
Again, this scene just reiterates for me how he's the chattiest Chad of all time.
Darcy, yeah.
Because you really see, he basically created this monster.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's no better than Frank. Well, maybe he's not, like, dissecting people and sewing a band together. So maybe, you know what I mean? In the sense, he's nearly as bad as Victor Frankenstein in creating
a monster.
A monster. Yeah, because he basically lowballs him.
Yeah.
10 years worth of work, £50. And then basically does what we've all done at one point in our lives, where you've taken somebody else's homework, crossed their name off, and just written your... Didn't even make an effort. He just crosses it off. At least, Tippex it out properly.
When you're plagiarising someone.
It's not until he goes into the printers, pickets the printers, sees that they're printing his music with Darcy's name on it.
Yeah.
And he goes to confront Darcy. And he's like, "Well, it's my name on my music. I don't know what the issue is."
Yeah.
Oh, proper chat. Yeah. They wound me up. And then he hits him with a stick.
Yeah.
And runs off with his little bird in the cart that doesn't do anything either.
Yeah. This scene hurt to watch. Not because he got hit with a stick. I mean, that was bad. But going back to the...
No, it's fine. It's fine hitting people with a stick.
Going back to what you were saying, is like everybody knows the feeling of scratching out somebody's name. I know the feeling of my name being scratched out.
Oh, I do as well.
Mr. Adam.
I have never scratched your name off of anything, Mike. Thank you very much.
No, I'm just generalising. Adam.
Dick.
So anyway, but Herbert Lom sounds really
on the next series of my podcast.
I mean, technically, it is your podcast. I'm just here for the ride, and to edit, and to help record, and to help plan.
Oh, right, come on now.
And to be the important piece.
Fucking Mike.
I'm not Darcy.
What?
How dare you?
No, you're worse. You're Paul Kremper, you are.
I'd rather be Paul Kremper than Darcy.
Oh, you'd rather destroy my monster? Well, that sounds fucking wrong.
The Phantom not being the Phantom at that point. What is it, Professor?
I keep calling him Eric because in almost every other Phantom of the Opera, he's called Eric. he's Professor Petrie.
That's it. Obviously, Professor Petrie at this point.
Yeah.
And he breaks into the printers to basically burn all of the printed work that's been done already. He had no intention of really doing anything else.
Yeah, so he was actually just destroying all of it.
And you see one of them falls out the furnace, I think it is, lands on the floor, and obviously it's a printing shop.
Yeah.
Long before the days of health and safety, shall we say, because there's flammable stuff bloody everywhere in there.
Just going to mention safeguarding again.
Poor guy then grabs what he thinks is water and it's not his acid. Splashes back on him. You don't really see it, obviously, until the climax of the film, which is quite a good reveal, I think. Yeah. I think it's quite well done as well. Mm. And as Peter Griffin says, we did get to see the gross ass of his face, and it was awesome. He runs out, then as the police arrive, and dives into the river. And we go back to them in the lair then.
I find her a bit strange. There is one point where he goes outside and then starts hitting his face against the wall.
He just has acid poured on him.
Yeah, I know, but you wouldn't smash your face against the wall.
Maybe he thought if he hit himself that hard, he'd forget about the pain in his face. Because he'd have another pain to deal with.
In his face.
Maybe. Shut up, Mike. This is a bit of an odd scene because he kind of begs him, or like he's, I implore you, can you, like, just let me work with her and then we can do the opera.
Yeah.
Never mind that I've just kidnapped her and,
yeah,
you know, left her up a bit.
It's very peculiar.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the faults of the entire film that...
Well, that and the bit they kind of just gloss over the dwarf here as well.
Yeah. The only conflict within the film is Darcy's character, which doesn't get resolved, and every now and then the dwarf causing a bit of drama.
Yeah.
Everything seems so passive in this film. For instance, Christine going out with Darcy for dinner, very passive.
Yeah.
Christine then sitting down with Harry for dinner, very passive. Harry then saying, "Oh, let's go do this," very passive. There's no question to it. The landlady giving up that information without questioning why you want to know or anything like that. Going to the printers and they give up that information as well. There's nothing, no obstacles. And then it gets to this scene and he's already kidnapped her. The dwarf has already killed a couple of people. And then they're like, "Yeah, right. Yeah, it's fine. Now keep her for a week. We'll see you at the opera."
Well, that's basically what happens. It just goes it goes into the finale, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good input, Mike.
Good input, film.
This seems to be an ongoing issue for Hammer. They kind of spend longer on, like, the beginning and the middle of the film, and then the end just kind of peters out a little bit. It's kind of ended quite abruptly. And this one is very bloody abruptly. Literally, it's the literal curtain to come down on the on stage and the fucking film finishes.
Yeah. Let's look at the six films.
Yeah.
The only one that I would say actually had a sufficient ending was The Curse of Frankenstein. Dracula, it was, we're going to chase him down to the castle and now he's dead. And that's it. We don't see what happens. We don't need, you know, they lived happily ever after or anything like that, but we need a little bit more. The mummy, they blow him to pieces and he goes into the swamp. End. Don't know what happens after that, whether the investigation's over, nothing. Skipping over the fourth episode.
I wonder why.
Curse of the Werewolf, he dies at the top of the clock tower. Okay, that's probably the second best ending that we've had. Because it leaves you with that forlorn feeling.
What would you say is the first thing? Curse of Frankenstein.
Curse of Frankenstein. Because that was the only one that had kind of like, inverted commas, definitive ending.
It wasn't, because you never really, you didn't see the guillotine drop, did you?
You didn't. And that's why I'm saying inverted commas, definitive ending. But we know that's his fate. So, and we know that Paul and Elizabeth are going home.
Yeah.
Brilliant. It wasn't the monster falls into the vat of acid and then roll credits.
Yeah.
We get closure.
That's true, actually.
And The Curse of the Werewolf, we don't get closure, but for the right reason. We want to feel depressed. We want to feel forlorn. And then we get into the climax of this film.
Yeah, it's as you said, it's not anything like big or special.
No.
Like, you kind of, it goes into the final scene now. You see, I suppose it's a pinnacle scene for the Phantom.
Yeah.
Because obviously he gets to see his work realised
in
its best form, so to speak, because he's coached Christine. He's coached her to sing it
the way he wants it to be sung.
And the way he originally envisioned it.
Yeah.
So it's him realising his dream here, but obviously it's quite short-lived.
And I assume Harry helped choreograph everything else because Darcy... Well, this is the thing. We have the confrontation of the Phantom of Darcy, which is nothing.
This is one of the film's faults for me. As I said at the beginning of the podcast, you don't get any closure or any real conclusion to Darcy.
Yeah.
He just has that one interaction with the Phantom where he takes his mask off, freaks out.
Mm.
It was a great scene because you didn't see the Phantom again.
But I mean, if he ran out screaming maniacally and got ran over by a horse or a carriage or something,
it would have been more satisfying.
Yeah, or he ended up locked up in, you know, an old Victorian
mental institution. I kind of hope like, that he fleed and just, like, it scared the shit out of him so much he just took everything and just fleed the country.
Mm.
That is what I hope, Aaron. That's like me filling the blanks in for my viewing pleasure, basically. Yeah.
Because they give you nothing.
They don't give you anything. You have that interaction with him where he whips the mask off him and then flees. You don't see him for the rest of the film. He's dead. He's gone.
Yeah, he's gone.
It was just... Oh, it was really frustrating.
I wanted something like The Lovely Bones.
What happened in that?
So the neighbour paedophile rapist flees. He throws Susie Salmon's in the safe into the sink pit, never to be recovered. So the family doesn't get closure, but they kind of like take her with them in their hearts and whatever.
Yeah.
And then it goes to like a little epilogue of him going to do it again with another girl, and then the icicle falls and hits him in the head, and then he falls down into the kind of like woods, just dead.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, I wanted to see something like that with Darcy. Like I said about like a horse and carriage.
Like a more satisfying finish to him, basically.
Yeah.
Because he never really gets come up and...
Exactly.
There's no consequences of his actions, basically. Because,
I mean, the Phantom, Professor Petrie, can put on a great show.
Yeah.
Like he wants to do. All the proceeds are still going to go to Darcy.
Yeah.
Because it's his
and
musical.
You blatantly know Darcy is not Linda's lesson at all.
No.
So he's going to go and do it again to somebody else.
Yep.
Creating Phantom of the Opera 2. the Phantom Returns. Yeah, from that, again, it's very much like the scenes earlier in the film. If you've seen one opera, you've seen them all. Sorry to any opera fans listening. I'm not a fan of them.
I'm a massive fan of musicals, but opera is not
a good musical, but operas don't really do anything for me.
Yeah.
You got that lovely shot of the Phantom with a single tear running down his eye. Quite a nice touch.
I thought, oh, it's a bit cliche, you know, having the single tear rolling
down. It was and it wasn't.
But I thought it was quite a beautiful moment for him to see his work realised and basically presented in front of him exactly as it should be.
Yeah.
It was really nice.
So, yeah, he's watching on in triumph. Yeah, just Charlie's been having too much paint again.
Yep.
Watching on from the rafters and one of the crew members see him, chase after him. This is all going on while Christine's absolutely killing it on the stage.
Yeah.
Ends, thunderous applause and everything, and then still chasing the dwarf. The dwarf decides, oh, I'm going to jump on that chandelier.
Yeah, that's smart.
Jumps on the chandelier. You can see the rope beginning to snap.
Yeah.
And the Phantom jumps into action straight out of his box. Leaps down from his box. That was a hell of a jump.
Yeah, that was a big jump.
That was a big ass jump.
But he also takes his mask off before he does.
That's probably, well, it is the only time in the film you see it.
Yeah.
And the quick shot of him before the chandelier falls on him.
Yeah.
Jumps onto the stage, pushes Christine out of the way, and then gets smushed.
Yeah, underneath the chandelier.
Yeah.
And then it has, like, the Dark Knight Rises shot of, like, the broken bat mask.
Yeah, that is basically the end of the film.
Yep, credits roll.
Final thoughts on the film, Mike?
It was fine.
Nothing special?
No.
Nothing you'd rewatch again?
I don't think it's all that memorable.
Okay.
I'd rewatch it. It's fine. Performances were really good. I mean, Michael Goff steals the film.
Yeah.
And I would say followed by Herbert Lom, especially in the exposition flashback scenes. Even Sears and D'Souza are able to carry the scenes that they're in. I do have a gripe with the dwarf. I don't like the character. I think it's very 1930s style of henchman. But without that character and without Darcy, we have no drama or conflict. What about you?
I enjoyed it. Definitely not the strongest film we covered in this podcast series, but definitely not the worst.
No.
Yeah, it was a good film, like I thought. But yeah, I wouldn't rush back to this, but like, if I was like just scanning my DVD collection looking for something to watch, I came across that and I hadn't seen it in a while, I'd be like, oh, I'll give it a watch. Yeah. I really enjoyed Michael Goff in this.
Yeah.
Fantastic, as you said, stole the show. Herbert Lom was very much the same. My only complaint... Well, there's a couple of complaints. I would have liked to see more of Herbert Lom as the Phantom and doing Phantom stuff and wrecking shit. Phantomy
things.
Phantomy things. I can't even say that word. Just more of that. But as I said, like, about the Mummy, you kind of want in a monster film. You want to see the monster doing monster stuff, basically.
Just
screwing stuff up and messing things up and kidnapping people and killing people and monster shit at the end of the
day. I think it is, it's something that's present in the majority of them, is making sympathetic monsters within their films.
Well, yeah,
with the exception of, say, Dracula.
Yeah, the Phantom was incredibly sympathetic, weren't they? My only other complaint with this film is, as I said when we covered the last scene, the lack of comeuppance for Darcy's character. Basically gets away with it scot-free. There's no happy ending for anything he's caused. Yeah, he just gets to walk off and walk away and gets all the proceeds from the fucking opera anyway. Yeah.
And I think there's a lack of information throughout the film as well.
Yeah.
They can be nitpicked, but there's anything things that I question.
Though. Like, anything can.
Why is the dwarf doing this? We have a throwaway line that, you know, he's a weird folk. How did they get all the stuff into the sewer? But also, the Phantom mentions that he's dying. But what's he dying from?
I don't know, Mike. Fucking hell. You're the type of person who watches Jeepers Creepers and not think about anything else besides, how the fuck did this guy get a personalised number plate?
I've never thought that, but now I have. I think, especially the, what is he dying from? And why does it have to happen now?
No, that's enough. That concludes another episode of the Truth Bar. No, I kind of get where you're coming from.
That little snippet of the Phantom saying, well, I'm dying, didn't push the plot along, didn't do anything for the story, and he ended up dying anyway. If they had put a time to it, I've only got a couple of months to live because, you know, this is eating away at me. It's almost like a parasite eating away at him. Christine agrees to sing for him, but Darcy is continuing with his show, which is... putting a thorn in the plan of Christine singing his music for the Phantom. So Darcy needs to get out of the way, but he's thwarting him at every opportunity because he is the wealthy man.
Yeah.
Then you have a story of conflict.
Yeah.
And you have a race against time. That's where I feel this film didn't have. There was no agency.
Yeah, okay.
Or any point.
I wouldn't go that far. So, Mark, being as this is our final episode...
Yes.
How have you enjoyed doing the podcast series?
Yeah, it's been, you know, stressful at times.
I was going to say, I have discovered new levels of anxiety doing this podcast. More so with the fact that it was like our first one, so...
Yeah. It's been trial and error. I mean, admittedly, this is our second attempt at this episode.
I was about to ask, are we going to... divulge any more information as to why?
I think people could make connections with what's going on right now in the world and a certain character within this film that we may have referenced.
Several times.
Yeah.
Several hundred times throughout the first recording. That's why we had to re-record it. That's why this episode is also late.
We don't want to bring a light perspective of people like Darcy. You know, this fictional character who's obviously based on people.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned earlier on in my little rant about safeguarding.
Yeah.
We made the executive decision to pull it.
And it didn't...
It didn't make anybody feel uncomfortable that we were bringing to light real life events.
Yeah.
When comparing it to somebody like Darcy.
Yeah. No, 100% agree.
But it's been fun.
Hopefully this will be the start of something more. But yeah, we'll see. So thank you all of you who have listened. Because this has been our first podcast. It has been a lot of trial and error there. Hopefully a couple of people have listened to you and they haven't seen the films and they've been like, okay, maybe they're worth checking out.
Yeah, and encourage people to look at some of our older horror films in Britain and across the world as well. Not just the US. You know, look to other cinemas.
Would you say there is any film in particular that we've covered on this podcast series that you wouldn't recommend people watch?
Two-Face, Dr. Jagger.
But yeah, thank you for listening, folks. Hope you've enjoyed it. And if any of you do watch the films, let us know in the comments what you think. Let us know in the comments what you thought of the podcast.
Yeah.
Unless you thought it was absolute shit, then don't comment. Just kindly scroll past. Please.
Oh, fragile egos.
Oh, no. But yeah, hopefully start something bigger and head to the website. Follow us on all the socials. Facebook, X. I keep going to say Twitter. It's not anymore. Facebook, X, Instagram, YouTube. We're looking to get more on there as well.
Yeah.
We've got our own podcast page on the website as well. So all the episodes and everything's on there. Take care. Anything to add, Mike?
Don't watch Two-Face, Dr. Jekyll.
Podcast should have ended like 15 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, on that note, thank you for listening, folks, and joining us for this journey into Hammer Horror. We will be coming back for season 2 with this at some point. We'll look to explore other options in the meantime.
Yeah.
But we'll cover that more in our bonus episode. So yeah, cheers.
Bye.